Welcome to Speak Up International with Rita Burt and Elton Brown.
We have had conversations on Speak Up International with people from a variety of points across the world. We've spoken with people from Brazil, from England, from South Africa, from places in the States. But today we're back home in Toronto, where we are going to be talking with Miss Caris Newton-Thompson. The woman we are chatting with today was born in Guyana, and since being in Canada, she has provided leadership in a variety of sectors. Caris was previously employed as an educator in Guyana, Jamaica, and Canada for over 30 years. Her ultimate role in public education system was that of manager of curriculum resources, where she vetted with an equity lens curriculum material. Caris recently served as chair of the recruitment committee of the Toronto Seniors and is now serving in her second term as a member of the City of Toronto's Confronting Anti-Black Racism Advisory Committee. The last thing I want to say about Caris Newton-Thompson is that she is an avid and happy gardener and enjoys cooking and baking. I want our listeners to meet our guest today, Miss Caris Newton-Thompson. Yay!
Hello, Miss Thompson.
Thank you very much, Rita, for your warm welcome and introduction, and also Mr. Brown. I just want to say before we even start that I really appreciate what you're doing, the recording of oral history from community members. I think this is a very important project that you're on. And because it is for our community, we in the Black community in particular, we don't tend to have that historical memory that is sustained within us. So when we have this repository of, you know, interviews with people who have lived in our community, then this will be helpful to our young people, because often they would say, they would start something and then they think they're the first to start it when things have been going on for many, many decades or even more than decades ago. So you are just doing a most valuable service to our community, and I thank you just heartily for that.
I wasn't expecting such beautiful comments. I'm not going to speak for Rita. I'm going to let her do her thank yous, but thank you so much. Rita, is there something you want to say before we get into this?
I want to echo what Caris says, because she is quite correct in saying that very often younger generations will start something and think that they are the first ones out of the gates, when indeed they're walking in the footsteps or the shoulders of people who have done a lot of wonderful things. So yes, I echo that. And it's really a joy to have you with us today.
Thank you.
No, thank you. Ms. Thompson, I looked at your bio and then information all over the internet, and your educational background is broad and wide. Can you tell us the five things that you've done educationally that you really enjoyed, and you can include any and all degrees?
I'm just laughing because to say five things I've done educationally is not how I would think about what I have done or achieved in my life.
How would you think about it?
I think about my background and how it has influenced my education. I think about coming from a village in Guyana called Buxton, where I was in elementary school. There wasn't any electricity. And by the time I think almost finished high school, they had some lights on the road and some people had electricity running to their house. But in that village, let me just back up and say, Buxton is one of the historical villages in Guyana. It was the second village to purchase, where our ancestors purchased the village from the enslavers after slavery was abolished, because they didn't want to work on the plantation anymore. And so they bought that village, they put their money together in a wheelbarrow, took it to the authorities, bought that village. And that was our village. They weren't going to work in the plantation. They were going to work farms, but they were going to get education. And that's how they were going to feed their families and do whatever. So, and then there's a little anecdote about our villagers where after they bought the village, they didn't want to pay taxes. And the enslavers were insisting that they pay taxes. So they sent some men over to Barbados to negotiate that. And the enslavers, in the usual divide and conquer way, told those six they don't have to pay taxes, but the rest of the village have to pay taxes. And that, of course, did not go down well. So the village decided that one day when the governor was passing on the railroad, that they were going to stop the train. But who stopped the train? It was six pregnant women from Buxton. They held hands and stood across the track and stopped the train so that the governor would give them audience, because they didn't want to give them audience before. So that's the village I'm coming from. And I grew up hearing about people reading their books under the street lights because they didn't have electricity at home, and people becoming lawyers and doctors and, you know, all kinds of professions out of Buxton. And then we had some excellent teachers in our schools who would go, they would come in on Saturdays and give you lessons and so on and so forth. And then we had someone who was called Sidney King at one point, but now UC Quiana, who owned a high school in Buxton. And what they used to do after school was to give lessons. His place was called Lessons Place. And no matter which high school you went to, which elementary school you went to, wherever, you go there after school. And the motto was each one teach one. And so if I am in high school and some elementary students came, they need some math help, I'd give them the help. I used to go to high school in Georgetown, St. Joseph High School, and I'd come back there and people who went to county would help me with my biology or literature or whatever I need. So when I talk about education, I'm talking about coming from that foundation. And Buxton, with all of that, they also had a Buxton scholarship, which was established years and years ago. I ended up benefiting from that scholarship to go to high school, right? So I talk about, when I want to talk about education, I talk about that. And then I talk about my family, my parents who were both firstborns and didn't get to, they did their elementary, but didn't get to go on to high school or so on, except for my mother, who as an adult went to do training at a place called Carnegie School of Home Economics. And she and I actually graduated the same day. I graduated from high school and she graduated from Carnegie. And so both parents were firstborn. They did not get to go to high school, but they were very, very keen on education. My father actually was an accomplished pianist. He went to the highest grade in pianos. But he didn't get to continue school because his parents died young and he had to take over the business, which was a bakery. So although my parents didn't go to high school, all of my siblings went to high school. They're all professionals. They all have degrees, more than one, some of them. In our family, we have two PhDs, two masters, two accountants, two educators and one engineer. All of us have degrees and professions. So, you know, that's how I come to education. That's how I talk about education.
So what I'm hearing then is that you're coming from a family that's One, self and highly motivating. You're coming from an environment, a milieu, where people were assertive and knew what their rights were and fought for it. And third, you're coming from a family who value education. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful.
Absolutely.
The other thing about Buxton is that we interviewed Murphy Brown some months back, and I'm sure she spoke about that Buxton experience as well. So Buxton, there's no question, goes down in the history of Guyana as being an extremely powerful place for people to live then.
And to be from.
Yes. I'm a little jealous. Now, based on your bio, Caris, education is in your DNA. You didn't say that, but I've put it like that. So tell our listeners, what was the impetus behind you choosing education as a career? Please.
Well, you know, that also is not straightforward. I wanted to be a chemical engineer. That's what I wanted to be when I went to high school. I was in chemistry, I was in sciences, and I wanted to be a chemical engineer. And then there were some circumstances in Guyana. My father was a baker, as I told you, and then there was the banning of flour and all of that. And so, you know, the situation was not that good, you know, in terms of money coming in. So I decided, when I finished my A-levels, that I was going to go work. So I became a pupil teacher. And so I got seduced from that into education because, you know, I was a pupil teacher and I started teaching at 16 as a pupil teacher because I had already done my O-levels at high. I don't know if you know what O-levels are, but that's a British external exam that people in the Caribbean took. Now they have something called CXC, which is the Caribbean version of that. But I did my O-levels at high school. And then, you know, I was asked to come back and do my A-levels. And I said, no, I want to go work. So I went and I became a pupil teacher. And so I was planning to go to the University of Guyana and get more education and so on. But I ended up coming to Canada. And when I came to Canada, I was still looking to be a teacher. So the first thing I did when I came was to get my O-levels evaluated. And, you know, in true form, Canada took my O-levels, which were grade 11 advanced, and gave me grade 12 general. But I didn't know any better, so I thought grade 12, I should do grade 13. So I just went and registered for night school grade 13. And so I did grade 13, and then I wanted to be a teacher. So I picked up the phone and I called the Ministry of Education and I said, what do you need to do to be a teacher? And they said, you have to have a degree and then you go to Teachers College. So I phoned U of T because, you know, like I was newly here, so I didn't know that U of T was so prestigious or anything. I just called them and I said, so what do you need to do to get into U of T? So they told me. And so I did my credits at grade 13, applied to U of T, got through, and, you know, that was it. That's, you know, so I got in and I started to, you know, work towards getting my education qualifications and so on. And so that's how I, you know, became a teacher rather than being a chemical engineer.
Can you tell me how many countries have you taught in? And secondly, I would just want to know, when the village was bought, was that day considered a holiday?
Okay, so I taught in three countries, in Canada, in Jamaica, and in Guyana. So, you know, those are the three places I taught. Like, I taught in Jamaica because when I finished Teachers College, there weren't any jobs in Canada, and I decided I'm teaching. So I started applying to the Caribbean because that was more attractive to me, to try to get to the Caribbean. So I applied to different places, but Jamaica was the first one that called, and they interviewed me on the phone. And in 2 weeks after my application, I was on a plane to Jamaica. So I taught in Jamaica. And, you know, as I mentioned before, I taught in Guyana as a pupil teacher. And then I came back and taught in Canada afterwards. The Purchase Day is not a holiday in Guyana, but Emancipation Day is. And I just want to add something you were saying about my interest in education. Not only am I interested in education, but I'm interested in racial uplift. So even as a young person growing up, I was helping people with you know, tutoring and that sort of thing in Buxton. But then when I came here, one of the first things I did was to volunteer with the Black Education Project. And I volunteered in educational organizations in our community, as well as with school boards and, you know, in different places. So I was with the Black Education Project, the OPBC, on Organization of Parents of Black Children, CABE, Canadian Alliance of Black Educators, AHEN, African Heritage Educators Association, and then the OBHS, and, you know, some other, the Library of Black People's Literature, you know. So I was in a lot of Black organizations, but I also volunteered at the Toronto Board before the amalgamation in a committee that they struck on the education of Black children. And I also volunteered during the same time at North York Board, where they had a committee where they struck in for the education of Black children. And more recently, I have volunteered with the Catholic District School Board, again, on a committee looking at the education of Black children. So I have been involved, you know, voluntarily and also paid work in the area of education.
Yes, voluntarily and paid work, you have no question about that. That's how I met you. So racial uplift is so critical, is so important for the quote-unquote leaders in our community. And you talked with us earlier, Karis, when I introduced you. But the people that we're talking with on this show are people that I refer to as community builders and silent giants. And there's no question that you're one of those people. So in your bio, you talk about vetting curriculum material. What were you looking for?
Okay, so I was doing that for the Toronto District School Board. And what I was looking for was curriculum that was appropriate, not only to grade levels, but culturally appropriate. And curriculum that was not cultural appropriation. And what I mean by that is sometimes you would be confronted, and I don't want to identify any particular submission, but you might be consulted by someone who may have visited a place, you know, maybe somewhere, I don't know, in space. And then they visited for 2 weeks, and then they came back and they have a book they're going to write about that. And I question that sort of submission, because how can you possibly in 2 weeks go to a place and come back and write about that place? Or sometimes people will go and they will take the artifacts of a place or certain symbols or whatnot and come back and want to copyright it and then say, well, you know, this is mine now. And it's like colonizing people's cultural property. And so I vetted for those sort of things. And I vetted to make sure that the material was, you know, reflected equity, diversity, and inclusion, because we have a very diverse population, students and teachers and community. And so those are the things I vetted for. And I vetted for things that were kind of fringe. You know, there's some areas where people want to sneak in, you know, maybe a religious thing or something in a public school board, and that is just not appropriate. So I would make sure that I read all of the literature that they send, and, you know, make sure that when I submitted the material to the committee, that I have all the background that's necessary so that we can make a proper decision.
So what courses did you teach at the Faculty of Education at U of T, University of Toronto?
Yes, I taught a section of the English as a Second Language course. It was called, let me see if I remember now, but I was doing the sociocultural part of English as a Second Language. So I taught about refugees and immigrants and their experiences. And again, around this whole area of equity, diversity, and inclusion, because you want teachers to know that even though someone might come from a different country, that they are just as able to be educated as a student who was born here. So, you know, but also they needed to know some of the hardships that refugees face and some of the issues in immigration, which we can see up to today. So I taught, you know, about that and for them to examine some of those issues and to think about those when they're teaching children, people's children.
You know, I want to go back to something you said a little earlier, and that is that when you came here, you contacted U of T to find out how you can become a teacher, and it told you about getting a degree. I came to Canada in 1973, and in those days, you did not have to have a degree. You just got a teacher's certificate or something like that to become a teacher in the public system. So they did switch, and I'm fully aware of that. That's interesting. Now, Clarice, you taught both children and adults. Did you have a preference?
I would say not. I did not. But just backing up, I came in 72. And so I called the ministry around then. So that's interesting what you said. I knew there were teachers who were teaching with grade 13. But when I called them and asked them, they told me that I had to have a degree.
Yeah, they were just beginning to switch over and to put that as a prerequisite to getting into teaching at around that time. Yes.
That was amazing how times have changed. You was a faculty advisor at the University of Ontario Institute of Technology. Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Okay, so after I retired, I was recruited to be a faculty advisor. And what I really enjoyed that, actually. What I did there was to go out and observe teacher candidates, because they were in teachers' college at the time, observe them in their teaching, and then I would meet with them afterwards and debrief and give them some pointers and so on. And then I would go and observe them. I had to do two observations of each teacher, and I make recommendation to the college, not recommendation about whether they should pass or fail, but just to let them know, you know, what I observed and what I suggested and whether there was a follow-up on the areas that I might have pointed out. And so I traveled all over the Greater Toronto area to do that. And it was just quite enjoyable. In one case, it was, you see students and teachers in different types of schools and school populations and socioeconomic settings. You know, I went to schools out in York Region where, you know, it's just very affluent and so on. I went to schools out in the north of Ontario that where it's a private school and they have their own area that they do their physical education. So I had to go and observe someone who was doing physical education in this vast natural landscape, you know. And I mean, it was just, I had never in my teaching in Toronto observed that sort of thing, except when we went away to a place where there was camping. So it was quite interesting.
Quite the experience, huh?
Mm-hmm.
So were they considered practice teaching in those days when you did that?
I would say that was practice teaching, yes. Okay. But, you know, it had, okay, you know that it used to be 1 year.
Yes.
For teacher training. So yes. I did that. That year was the year I was at the at that institution was the last year they were doing 1 year.
Okay.
After then, they went on to 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of your roles was to interview aspiring teachers trying to join education programs. Tell us, tell our listeners, Caris, what would give one candidate the edge over another in terms of getting into the program?
Okay, so, you know, as you know, most candidates, when they come, they have what was asked for, the minimum that's asked for in their application. So things that would get them over, and I didn't make the decision, I just made recommendations. So what would get candidates over? One thing was that they, because nowadays they look for this a lot, where they had experience volunteering or working in the area where they want to teach. So if they want to teach middle school, they should have known middle school people and they worked with them. They have an idea of who it is that they're going to be teaching in the future. So if they have experience in that area, so the program used to count the number of years or weeks or whatever of experience that someone will have. And then the other crucial thing was that they had to be aware and perhaps demonstrate some practice in the area of equity, diversity, and inclusion. So they have to. There were certain questions we asked them to get at their understanding of those issues. You know, of course, when they go to teachers' college, they would be taught about those things. But coming in, they have to have a sense and an understanding of those issues. You know, so those were two critical things, I would say, that were helpful. But of course, there were situations where students, because of their economic circumstances, had to work and couldn't put in the amount of time that would look impressive on an application for, you know, so many hours of volunteer time. We took that into consideration as well, if they had to work or, you know, what their economic circumstances were.
I do think that is important, considering every facet of an individual before you can actually determine which way they should go educationally. You were the Ontario Principals Council. You worked in that department. Can you tell us a little bit about that place? And by the way, I also know that you were also an equity consultant.
Yes, I am. Still.
You are.
Yes.
Oh, okay. So tell us a little bit about things.
Okay, so the Ontario Principals Council is, the best way to put that is it's similar to the Teachers Federation, except it's not a bargaining entity. So principals belong to the council. They join the Ontario Principals Council, and by being a member of the council, they get protection. For example, if parents would complain about them or teachers or their fellow administrators, it's, you know, principals and vice principals are a member of the council. And so they get protection, support, advice from the staff there. If there are any issues that they encounter where they need some kind of representation or a sounding board, sometimes the person doesn't have to come out and help them, but they can talk to a person on the phone or so on. And if they get into any legal situation, then they are lawyers there who would represent them in whatever situation it is. And so it's also an organization that offers a lot of courses. They offer the principal's course, and I'm not sure if they offer the supervisory officer's course as well, but they offer the principal's course, and they offer a lot of courses on different aspects of leadership within the educational sector. So what I do in my role is often people will come to the OPC, Ontario Principals Council, OPC. They would come to them and say, I'd like to offer a course of principals and vice principals in this area. And so my role is to review those courses and make sure that they are in compliance with the equity, diversity, and inclusion specifications of the Ontario College of Teachers, because they're the ones who have to approve the course. So I review the courses, and then the next step is for it to be sent to the college, and then they would approve or not. So that's what I do there. That's one of the things I do. I do a few things.
So would your recommendations be used to help determine whether or not that project would be accepted or not?
I do not make recommendations. I review and I give the results of my review. So I have never followed up to see what has resulted. I just know there was one time when there was something that was particularly not following the guidelines and other things. And so I made comments, and then they actually ended up asking me and another person, another employee. Well, I'm not an employee, I'm a consultant. So I'm not a consultant to redo that course, because they were just a few problems that didn't seem to be able to be addressed.
Taris Newton Thompson, I've been chomping at the bit to ask you to talk about your experience with the Black History Society.
Oh, you're chomping at the bits, are you? Mm-hmm. Okay, so I was a volunteer at the Ontario Black History Society for about 8 years. I was really, really excited when Dr. Daniel Hill started the society in 1978. That was the year I graduated from graduated with a history, an honors history degree, my first degree at U of T. And I was just really excited, but I went to Teachers College the next year. And then I came out and there were no jobs, so I had to leave and go to Jamaica. So when I returned in 1983 and there were still no jobs, I decided to, okay, I'm going to go back and do my master's. And so I had Fridays off from school, and I took my Fridays and I went down to the society and I was volunteering. I didn't care what they gave me to do. I stuffed envelopes, I put envelopes in the mail, I licked envelopes, I did whatever. I was just so happy that we had a Black History Society. And so I volunteered, you know, for that first year. And then I made suggestions and so on while I was there, because, you know, sometimes when they had a meeting, they didn't have enough people coming out and so on. So I made suggestions about having a program before the meeting so people come for that and then they'll stay for the meeting or whatnot. So, of course, they said, okay, your idea. Let's have a program committee. You'll chair it. So we started to have a program committee. And then we had like 200 people coming out for things because we'd have a really interesting program and so on. And so I served first as a committee chair, and then I was elected to the board. And I served on the board for about 3 years. And then I was elected president, and quite surprised, although I shouldn't have been, because I was on the board and then I was vice president. And it was Glace Lawrence, who was the executive director. She said, Taris, you know, you're going to be the president next, because I was just so busy with the work that I wasn't thinking, I wasn't ambitious in that way. I was just excited that we have a Black History Society and we can do all these things historically at the society. So during my presidency, we started the Black History Month kickoff brunch, which is now in its 36th year. Aita Sadhu and I did that. We had an archival research project where we had people go and interview folks from Southern Ontario. So there was one researcher working in Toronto, and the other one was traveling around Southern Ontario and just interviewing people, seeing if they have any artifacts that they want to contribute to the Ontario archives, or just to identify where they were with people. So there's a note made so that if in the future they want to put them in the archives or whatnot. My exciting thing was to get a Black history tour of Toronto. So I hired a researcher. She did the research. We had a Black history walking tour, and we had a Black history bus tour of Toronto. And then we also had many seminars and symposia and so on. So we had speakers like Dr. Doreen Lewis. She was then the mayor of Annapolis Royal, Nova Scotia. She was the first Black mayor. And we had, during the time when they were celebrating Columbus, we decided we had to do an anti-Columbus symposium. So we did that, and we invited Dr. Joy Gleason Carew. And you might recognize the Carew name. There's Claire Carew here, but there is Jan Carew. And that Joy Gleason Carew actually happens to be his wife. And she came and did our anti-Columbus lecture. And we participated in things like Salafi, celebrating African identity at Harborfront. And we involved some Black students at U of T in Black History Month presentation. And we made sure to let Showboat know that we were not supporting them. And, you know, just several things that happened. I was very excited to be part of the Ontario Black History Society. And, you know, just enjoy doing that work.
Now, did you go to the brunch that was held two Sundays ago?
No, I wasn't able to attend.
Okay. And you mentioned the Carew name. Jan Carew came into our store once. Charlie Roach brought him in. Mm-hmm. So I was very fortunate to get to meet Jan Carew.
Yes. So I wonder if it was the time when they came for the presentation at the society.
Might very well have been.
Yes. Yes. He's a very well-known Guyanese author.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
You are a volunteer. It appears that if you're not actually working, you are volunteering. And I want to know what your involvement was as an equity consultant. What does that mean?
Okay, so this was not volunteering. And also, let me just correct you. Volunteering is work. It's hard work.
It's hard work.
Yes. As an equity consultant, I called myself that. At the school board, they called me a race relations advisor. And I didn't like that title because I don't even know what race relations are. So I titled myself equity consultant. And at that time, it was more looking at anti-racism. We didn't have the term anti-Black racism at the time, but we were looking at anti-racism in terms of just the racism that is experienced by people of color and Indigenous people in Canada. And I was hired by the school board. So I was promoted, I should say, by the school board because I had been working there as a teacher and department head and so on. So that was a promotion I had applied for. And we were looking at working with teachers to have them. Well, I say we, but I was mainly the office. So I was working with teachers to have them look again at how they worked with students of color. For example, we had, and this is not news, and I don't know if this still continues today, but where students, especially Black students, will go to guidance counselors and say, I would like to be a teacher or a doctor or a lawyer. And the guidance counselors often would say to them, well, you know, that will take so long and it will be so expensive. You'll have to get a student loan. If they ask they say they want to be a teacher, they would be advised to go and work in a daycare. Just go for 2 years at a community college and you'll be finished fast. You don't have to go for 4 years at, you know, or 3 years at a university and then go to teacher's college. And so we talked to them about that because, I mean, underpinning that is that whole idea that they want to keep Black people in the roles of hewers of wood and fetchers of water. So when I was vice principal and principal, I took my collective agreement that I had as a teacher to school with me when I spoke with students, because sometimes they even had the impression that teachers weren't making that much money. And so it doesn't make a difference if you go and work in a daycare or you work in a school. And so I would take out my collective agreement and say, look, this is what you get as a first year teacher, year one, you know, in even if you're in the first category. And here, if you get certain education, you could start at the fourth category and get a better pay. But this is what you make. And this is what they make as daycare people. So teaching makes, you know, gives you lots of money. And you get your summers off. And you get your Christmas off. And you get March. So, you know, I would tell them this because they, you know, some of the students, they get sort of feeling that, you know, being a teacher wasn't paying that much money or whatnot. But fundamentally, the anti-racism work was to look, critically examine and try to disturb that whole notion that certain students of color could not achieve, you know, the prejudices and the discrimination that occurred at different levels in schools. We try to work with teachers and with administrators and trustees to re-examine some of those things and you know, try to steer them in another direction to try to disrupt that negativity. But of course, when you're in a role like that, they turn on you because somehow when you're pointing things out, you are the problem. It's not, you know, the people who are, excuse me, who are the ones, you know, doing some things. So it was in that role, there were in each school board, there was a person in that role and we used to meet together and so on. And we, you know, we share some of the issues that come up from doing that kind of work. And there were also people in the cities, like the city of Toronto had a person, city of North York and city of York had a person who, you know, all these race relations people were, you know, were being hired at that time. But I, in my opinion, they hired us to make sure that the city or whomever would say, we have a person in that job. And so in my case, I decided you hired me, I'm going to do the job. You know, you're not going to just say you have me. I will do the job. So one of the things I'm proud of from that was that we were the first school board to say that students will not go on a field trip to see Showboat. And once we came out with this, then the other school boards took it on.
You hang out at a lot of universities. I want to know, what did you think of York University and their teacher education program?
Okay, so I was not familiar with it. I used to do the recruitment, the interviews for York, but I have not. I did all four of my degrees at the University of Toronto, I'm ashamed to say. And I think it's just because, you know, once you're there, you don't have to go back, send in your transcript again, whatever. They have all the records. So when I apply for another program, you know, I, as long as you're qualified to do whatever, you just apply and do it. So I didn't know. I used to go to interviews, so we would get some lectures on that. And I actually used to do some, while I was the equity advisor, I used to do some conferences with people from York University. But I just consider my involvement peripheral. I did do my principal's course part one at York, but it wasn't a York course per se. It was a course that was taught by retired principals or at York. So I don't have a lot to say about York, except that I had the opportunity to go and interview students and that sort of thing. And I still go there for lectures and so on because I donate to the Jean Augustine Chair.
Well, I'll brag a little bit and say that my undergraduate degree came from York, but then I segued to U of T, where I met you as well, because we were both doing graduate work at OISE. But that's for another interview. So, Caris Newton Thompson, there's no question that you are a community builder, and as you said, racial uplifter, and we applaud you for that. So I want to hear from you, what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
So that is easy because I got that advice from my late sister, my older late sister. She was the first and I'm the second. And the advice she gave me was, okay, so I came, as I told you, I did my grade 13 and then I was applying to university. And she had been going to U of T part-time. And she said to me, don't go part-time. Go full-time. Because she had been going part-time and then she got married right after. So she got married young, like about 23 or something. And she said to me, go full-time. Right? Because she was seeing that it was interrupting her studies, going part-time. And so that, I think that's the best advice. I went full-time. It wasn't all that easy. I had to work and so on and go, but I think that really paid off for me in the end.
Which do you enjoy doing most, being the gardener or baking?
I can't distinguish because being a gardener, it's, well, of course, you're outdoors. And I like to grow food as well as flowers and so on. And I like to figure out, you know, why things are working the way they are or they're not working and so on. But I also like baking and I like making treats. I make dark chocolate covered almonds and I make dark chocolate covered ginger and all of that. So I just, when I'm doing that, you know, I make them and they're different shapes and whatnot. And I just like, and I take pictures and send to my sisters all the time. So I, you know, like I just enjoy those things. And the most that I enjoy about both things was that people actually eat them. So when I garden and I reap things, I give to some of my neighbors and my husband, he loves to reap. So he would go out and reap and eat. And I just like the idea. You pick it now and 5 minutes later, you're going to eat it. So it's, you know, and then when I bake things, I sometimes drive all the way across the city to my friend Clem and take stuff for him. My big brother friend Clem or my friend Angela or different people. I bake and I take it out and I just like people enjoying what I do. So, you know, that's. So it's hard to say one or the other. And of course, in the summer, I bring flowers in from the garden all the time. And so it beautifies the place and, you know, all of that. And if somebody's in a hospital, I take some for them, you know, that sort of thing. So, you know, I couldn't tell you one or the other.
When you are gardening, do you find that more relaxing than baking or vice versa?
No, it's two different kinds of things. Sometimes gardening is not all that relaxing because my neighbor's cats come into my garden and think it's their washroom. And so I have to be cleaning that stuff up, you know, so it's not always that relaxing. I actually had to go out and buy something called a scarecrow that I put in the middle of the backyard and attach the hose to it. So when they come through the hedge, the water just squirts on them and they have to run away.
It's called cruelty to animals, Miss.
No, it's
Miss
called
Harris.
Spraying them with water.
Do you remember some years ago you gave me a plant, the corn flower?
No, it's echinacea. Yeah. No, every I don't remember spring, giving every, you.
Yeah, every spring when it comes up, I think of you because it blooms and blooms and it really beautifies the garden. That purplish flower?
Yes.
Blue
yes.
purplish flower. You gave me a plant once. You brought it to the store.
Oh, but before I do that all the time.
And you don't remember.
No, I don't.
Before we let you go, because you're really enriching this conversation, and I'm having a ball just talking with you and hearing your story, but I want to put you in an auditorium with Black graduating students in the education program. What three gems would you offer them?
I would say that the first thing, if they're Black educators, then I would say, know yourself, know your history, know your people, and don't start with enslavement, because knowing your people started hundreds of years ago. We were the first people on the earth. So know yourself, be grounded in that. And the reason I say that is because if you're not grounded in yourself, you can easily be tipped over with when you come up against challenges and so on. You know, you have to be solid in who you are and not ashamed of it and not bother about the media and how they depict our people. You know your own history. You're not taught it in school. You're an educator. You can go out and find the information. So that's one thing. And then I would say value and encourage Black students. We don't have a great population of Black people in the city or Black students or whatnot. But often what happens is that you go into a school as an educator, and then there might be people who would be saying negative things about students, about Black students. And unless maybe they're on a sports team or something, and then they say wonderful things about them. Mostly. So you need to value and encourage Black students. And when I say that, what I mean is you get to know that student. No matter what anybody tells you about the student, don't go on that. You go on your relationship with the student in your classroom. Don't go into the classroom with a bias against the student because somebody whispered to you, oh, that family, whatever, or that student, you know, just go with a clean slate. And make sure that you get to know that person one-on-one. And I'm just deviating to say, I remember when I was vice principal, I used to see this young man walking around with his pants down to wherever and so on. And I looked at him and I thought, this is going to be my project. So I would see him in the hall and I say, hi. Then I found out his name. And then I say, hi, Tom, Dick, Harry. And he's like, you know my name? I say, I know everything, I tell him. So then I checked his interim report and I saw he did well at one course. And I saw him again. I said, hey, I see you did well in whatever. You know what's on my report card? And I said, I know everything, right? So I keep just every time I see him in the hall, I said something to him. Now, I don't know if I'm responsible for this. But this kid started pulling up his pants, and the next year he got on the honor roll. And so his father came to parents' night. First time the father said, I never even got any information before about parents' night. This is the first time the father came to parents' night. And then he went on and he graduated from high school. And for the prom, the father hired a stretch limousine for him and his friends. He dressed up in this white suit, and, you know, and I don't know if I should take credit for that. But the point I'm making is I took interest in him and I didn't say anything negative. I just kept telling him little things of praise, and he figured, oh, she's noticing me, you know. So I don't know if that helped him, but I'm just saying you take that interest and, you know, instead of looking for a negative thing to say or to do, try the positive. You get more, you know, response from the honey. And then I have like two more things, so bear with me. So the next thing I would say is take care of your health, because as a teacher, it is a very taxing kind of role, and you need to take some time to take care of your health. So I know people do lessons plans every night and whatever, and then sometimes on the weekend, they're looking for stuff and whatnot. Carve out some time for you. If you go on a hike or you do bicycle or whatever you do, carve out that time, because you don't want to burn out, you know, because that's easy to happen, especially in these days when you have, you know, sometimes you have classes where you're teaching on Zoom and you're teaching in person, and you know, like there's just a lot expected. So make sure you carve out that time. And then the final thing I would say is to make sure you have either an individual or a group of Black teachers or educators that you can touch base with. You know, you might have other network, but you need that Black kitchen cabinet, because whatever you experience as a Black person would be more common among you as Black educators than it would be with other people. And I'm not saying not to do that with other people, but make sure you have that, a Black person or more than one that you can touch base with and to just troubleshoot or do whatever you're doing, because that is also crucial for your mental health.
Ms. Thompson, I want to say there are two types of educators. There's an educator, and then there's an educator who cares. And you happen to fit under the category of educator who cares. It's evident through all of what you've done, starting with where you're from, which was a community effort to buy the land so that you could be independent, which is extremely important. And from there, you were able to attend the schools that you felt were necessary so that you were able to reach your personal and educational goals. Because of your education, you were able to more or less move to any position that you wanted to, from a faculty advisor to equity consultant. You handled volunteer work in under many capacities, which is always something that I think is important when we talk about giving back to the community. That is the one is one way that we can definitely give back to the community. I just want to thank you so much for spending the time with us this afternoon. This is yet again another treasure that we can add to the Speak Up International vault. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate the time that you've taken and that you've chosen me. I, you know, I'm just so humbled by all of that.
Well, your story adds so much to our history and to our culture, and I wish that you would continue telling it. And perhaps one day you will put it in a book.
Thank you for listening to Speak Up! Exclamation Point International. If you wish to contact Ms. Caris Newton Thompson, please submit your name, your email address, and the reason why you wish to contact Ms. Newton Thompson to info@speakuppodcast.ca. Are you interested in the opportunity to be interviewed and have your cause promoted by Speak Up! Exclamation Point International? We invite you to contact us by sending a message that includes your name, company or organization name, the valuable service you offer to your community, and your email address to info@speakuppodcast.ca. Worried about your confidence as an interviewee? Don't fret. Speak Up! Exclamation Point International can provide you with the necessary training so you can shine during an interview. To receive training information and a 10% discount about the Speak Up! Exclamation Point International's podcast interviewee training program, email us at info@speakuppodcast.ca. You can reach us using Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. To connect to our podcast, use Spotify or your favorite podcast platform and search for Speak Up! International. You can also find our podcast using our web address, www.speakuppodcast.ca. Our logo has the woman with her finger pointing up, mouth open, speaking up. At Speak Up! International, we aim to inspire, to inform, and to educate.